Very good. Let me know if you you can't hear me. I'm going to try to remember to say when I've changed the slides, and I fear that I didn't number them again. But as Ignacio said, because I think my last talk on stochastic programming was actually 3 years ago. I have some. The first half, I would say, is kind of a quick overview of the various issues there, just to remind people. Because I think we really need to have a review of the basics before some of the sampling methods and really continuous distribution issues will make sense. So I'm moving on to slide two, and of course I didn't number them. I apologize for that. So again, I'm going to talk briefly. This is standard stuff. I'm going to talk define stochastic programming, talk a little bit about industry, but then towards the end, as I mentioned, the last two bullets on sampling approaches and scenario reduction techniques and that type of thing. So on to slide three. So again, a lot of things that we look at are deterministic models, but and really, you know, people may disagree with this, but I tend to think of them as kind of linear, nonlinear, integer, and dynamic. And of course, there are overlaps there. Some stochastic models, why these are of interest in applications is that often the parameters and data are, in fact, not known with certainty, and you can have a very poor model by taking expectation, and that's been demonstrated in a variety of contexts. So on to the next slide. So what's a stochastic program? Stochastic program is a mathematical program, so the things we're all used to, linear program, nonlinear program, that type of thing, in which some of the parameters are random. And what we're going to spend a lot of time talking about is a two-stage linear program with recourse, and I would view that as the simplest, maybe perhaps not the simplest, but maybe the simplest interesting case of a stochastic program. And we have some assumptions that we're going to maintain throughout this talk, though people are exploring relaxations of these assumptions. But one would be that the probability distribution for the uncertainty is known and is independent of the decisions you made. And Ignacio and one of his former students, Vikas Goel, had, I guess it was in 2006, had a math programming paper that looked at this and built on several other papers where for the application they were looking at, this was absolutely not the case, and they had some very nice results for these problems. But they are very challenging in general. And another assumption is that the stages interact linearly in a very nice way. So the linear, you know, it's not just linear that you're solving one linear program after another. It's that the way that the linear programs interact is, in fact, also linear. So again, this is the simplest, in some respects, the simplest interesting case of these problems. And yet I still feel that there are open questions with even something as simple as the two-stage stochastic linear programs. We're learning a lot about how to solve these things. Okay, next slide, the one that begins formulating stochastic programs. As Ignacio mentioned, a couple years ago we had a talk on Markov decision processes where actually the stages are also defined. And so you can think of these as not necessarily time periods, but times during which you may make a decision. So in fact, it's actually an important thing. You could build a model where the stages were in January and July, but in fact the time periods in between, perhaps you just weren't allowed to make a decision. So you're only allowed to set inventory targets every quarter or something. That doesn't mean that the time in between can't be covered by the model, but the model to some extent skips over those times because there's no possibility for us to control the system. So we tend to think of X as the decision we make now, and then after we've made the decision for X, we get to observe some random variable omega. And so this is really important, that the X is not allowed to look ahead, to preemptively know what's going to happen with omega. And in fact, we can formulate this explicitly as for every omega, you have to make the same decision X. However, after omega occurs, we're allowed to make what we call a recourse decision or corrective action Y, and that Y is allowed to know what the particular realization of omega was. And so the typical objective is to minimize the first stage costs plus the expected second stage costs. And believe it or not, these stochastic linear programs are almost as old as the linear program itself. The first paper on this was written by Danzig in 1955, and Beale also simultaneously wrote a very looked at a similar problem in 1955. So this is you're almost with a field as young as OR. We can start calling these classical approaches because people have been considering them for 50 years. I will say in the last 10 years, however, many of the assumptions that I'm going to give you, and this is a subject for a different day, have now been relaxed. You know, people are looking at risk issues. Risk averse objectives, that type of thing, and so virtually everything I've said, in fact, there are people actively trying to relax the decisions. Some of them are proving pretty hard, but there are nice results on many of these issues. Okay, moving on to the second, formulating a stochastic program. And so what we have, if you we have the familiar linear program at the top there, but a two-stage stochastic linear program with recourse, as we abbreviate that, it looks very similar, except that we have this funny function Q, and the Q is the expected recourse function, which gives you the expected optimal cost, the expected cost of the optimal second-stage decision given the first-stage vector X. So, I mean, this is pretty straightforward. Q of X is simply what you should do afterwards in expectation. It's the expected cost of your recourse action. So going forward, a slide, what is allowed to be random? Well, we're going to allow a lot of things to be random. These are classical models to some extent. The objectives, constraints, right-hand sides, the matrix describing the relationship between X and Y, to put that into vector notation, we will define the objective to be Q, the right-hand side to be H, and then the matrices that allow the X's and Y's to interact, we call a recourse matrix as W and a technology matrix T. We'll see that in a little bit. Stochastic programming is, as I say, kind of a relatively old field, but it's not so old that there's standard notation. So unfortunately, you will see people using different notation. In fact, I'm guilty of that myself. I think I'm pretty sure it's easy to find papers in which I've been inconsistent. Okay, the T and W and H seem pretty standard, though. And so this is what Q of X looks like. So it turns out, for any scenario, we're going to allow Q of X and omega to be simply minimize the second stage objective. And then you see in these constraints, all they do is they relate W to X linearly. And then Y will be non-negative. So again, this is a classical two-stage stochastic program. The objective, what we really want to do, as we mentioned about six slides ago, is we want to minimize the expected cost of these problems. So in fact, the function Q of X is equal to the expected value of all of these possible outcomes. And again, notice that the relationship between X and Y must be described linearly. There's, to my knowledge, that's an assumption that people are kind of hesitant to try to attack. This is certainly for a lot of these problems. Even just having this structure makes things somewhat difficult. Okay, so moving on beyond this to properties of the expected recourse function. Well, what do we know about this function? Well, fortunately, and this has been known for quite some time, this goes back to the Danzig paper. We know that Q of X is convex. However, if you start to stray from the standard model, this classical thing that we're describing, in fact, it's very easy to have this fall apart. So something as simple as requiring integer recourse will, in general, blow convexity away. And in fact, in that case, you can often find that the function is discontinuous. But every algorithm, I would say, for solving these problems exploits this convexity in one way or another. And so we'll talk about kind of the standard way for doing that. And now, for the standard case, if there are a finite number of scenarios, then this Q of X is piecewise linear. So, however, what we're going to look at is, in the second half of the talk, is the situation where we're going to relax this. And so in that case, you will often have the fact that it is no longer a piecewise linear function. Okay. So moving on to this picture of the expected recourse function. So again, this is just an illustration. It's convex, and with a finite number of scenarios, it's also piecewise linear, so it looks like this. Okay, moving on to an extensive form in the quotes. So one thing we could do is we could solve a really big linear program, which is known in the literature as the extensive form. And so this is just what you see here. You explicitly account for the x's and the y's all in the same formula simultaneously, and you have a set of those t, w, and h constraints for all possible realizations. By the way, let me know, because I've covered this before, and I know there are a lot of people in the audience who actually have worked with these. I'm going reasonably quickly, but feel free to interrupt if you have questions. Okay, so this is what it looks like. We could do this. However, it's easy to imagine that for a reasonable number of scenarios and a reasonable, you know, just a reasonably sized problem, nothing too extravagant, these problems, this becomes too big to even load into memory. So this is what the constraint matrix would look like. Now, I've moved forward a slide, and we have kind of a diagram of what this looks like. And so you can see they're not aligned perfectly, but this is what the matrix will look like. There's an awful lot of zeros in this matrix. And in particular, so I've only drawn really the non-zero parts here. What's interesting is, of course, the y's don't interact with each other. Okay, and so we would call this kind of block separable or staircase structure. And of course, the key to solving large scale optimization problems is exploiting some kind of special structure, and this is special structure that we know how to exploit, certainly. So going forward a slide, we have the staircase structure, dual block angular. It's critical for solving stochastic linear programs. We often call the x variables linking variables. So without the existence of those variables, we would have a bunch of separable problems. So if you hear the term linking variables, dual block angular structure, that type of thing. So that's synonymous, and typically that's going to lead us to some kind of decomposition approach, and that's what we will see, in fact. So I'm going to talk a little bit more about that, but in the meantime, I've moved on to applications. And, you know, I'd say 20 years ago that stochastic programming applications were kind of few and far between, but now I would say that's not at all the case. I just came back from InForums, and there's a large number of problems where they are using stochastic programming to solve, you know, industrial-sized instances of one type or another. And so some things that people have looked at, they've certainly looked at investment decisions and portfolio planning. Hopefully those were ones where they estimated probabilities well. Power generation has been a classical problem that's been around for at least 20 years. So unit commitment problems under uncertainty, that would be when do we turn on certain generators, trying to anticipate demand and that type of thing. Supply chain management, as you'd imagine, there's a large amount of interest there. Telecoms have done a fair amount, and really this is just scratching the surface. There are an awful lot of interesting applications of stochastic programming. So the next one slide is, how can I solve a two-stage stochastic linear program? Well, this is something we actually feel like we have a good sense about how to do it, but I would argue that we're still learning a lot. The state of the art, which I won't be able to talk to you about yet, I would say is some work by Jeff Lindroth, who I don't know if he's logged in, and Wright, who's used some nonlinear programming techniques to really come up with much better ways to solve these than the classical method I'm going to describe. Okay, so let's just conceptually. I've hit the button once. Now I have a bunch of green blobs in the slides, and so this is, we can think of this as our problem. So we really have a set of first stage decisions, but then for each scenario, as we go down, we have another set of decisions. And the key to this is that, in fact, the first stage is going to interact with each of these scenarios, but the scenarios aren't going to interact with each other otherwise. So hitting the mouse again, you can see that we're going to need to pass information back from the first stage down to each of the scenarios in a standard decomposition approach, but then we're also going to need to get some information from the scenarios back up to the first stage. And so what happens here, I'm going to hit this again, is that the standard method, which is based on Bender's decomposition, we're going to send candidate solutions from the first stage. So the first stage might say, gee, what if I were to make this decision? And all the scenarios will tell the first stage problem or the master problem in the form of a linear cut, how good is this solution? And not only that, that's pretty easy to do, but the beautiful thing about this is it's going to give you information. It's going to give the first stage information about every other possible first stage solution. So it's going to say, I can tell you how much it's going to cost me if you do this, use this X, but using LP duality, I can actually give you information about every other decision you might be considering. So we'll illustrate that geometrically soon. So moving forward one, I've gone to the next slide. Again, how do we solve the simplest form of stochastic programs? Take simplest into, you know, with a grain of salt. In fact, there are many simpler stochastic programs that people have looked at with things called simple recourse. They may not even have recourse, that type of thing. But, you know, under these two-stage stochastic LPs with recourse, so what do we do? The one thing is this L-shaped method, and that's, I don't know, I don't think that's a particularly descriptive name, but as with so many other things, we're stuck with it. And there are a couple versions with that. There have been numerical computational enhancements. This is something where I think we're still learning how to solve these problems, in particular as we have larger and larger two-stage LPs. A couple other things that people have looked at that are beyond the scope of this hour. People have sometimes used interlinearization methods and basic factorization methods. I don't know if we can conclude that these aren't going to be as promising, but they haven't attracted as much attention as the L-shaped method. Certainly one reason is the L-shaped method actually can apply to first-stage integer decisions, and these other methods, I think that's a little bit more difficult. So that's certainly one advantage that they have. But it also just could be, you know, that there are good opportunities here that people aren't pursuing. Okay, so going forward, I'm going to tell briefly about the L-shaped method. And again, I'm going to go over this. This is, I think, a slide that I showed 3 years ago. But what we really want to do is approximate the convex term. So this Q of X, in fact, of course, Cx plus Q of X is also a convex function. And we're going to come up with supporting hyperplanes. And we don't want to solve every possible solution X. For even an LP, there's an enormous number of those. So again, we divide the problem into two stages. We have a master problem and subproblems. And the master problem will have a subset of all possible cuts using polyhedral theory. We could reformulate this using an enormous number of cuts, but we may not need to see them all. Hopefully we won't need to see them all. And so it generates two types of cuts. One is feasibility cuts. That's to say, to ensure that we only come up with X's that for which the second stage is feasible for all possible demands. So, for instance, if the first stage is how many facilities should I build, and then we realize a random demand, the feasibility cuts might say something like, you have to build enough capacity to make sure that under every scenario we can meet all the demand. I mean, if we had a penalty for unmet demand, we wouldn't need such feasibility cuts. And feasibility cuts, believe it or not, actually, for some problems, the vast majority of the cuts generated are feasibility cuts. So it really depends on the problem. For others, you need zero, and you can tell that a priori, or they just aren't a big issue. Now, optimality cuts, they represent this, they relate the second stage cost to the first stage constraints. Okay. So going forward, just a little bit of technical detail. So at some arbitrary iteration, we're going to have an L-shaped restricted master problem. We're going to use theta to represent the second stage costs. We still have these first stage constraints, AX equals B. But then we have a set of feasibility cuts, which we represent by dx greater than or equal to small d, and we index those by L, and we might have S of those at some iteration. Then we also have optimality cuts, rather. Now, notice that the feasibility cuts don't have theta in them. So, these are simply to ensure that you will generate X's for which a feasible solution Y exists in the second stage. That does not necessarily, it doesn't tell you anything about whether or not they're optimal. And there's some interest in trying to get a little bit more objective function information into these feasibility cuts. But that's not really standard methods. And then the optimality cuts will, again, we just index those by E, and I'd say this is becoming standard notation. Those relate, again, in a linear fashion, the decisions you might make in X, and they relate them to theta in, again, a linear set of linear constraints. So moving forward, I'm just going to tell you how to do these. This is pretty straightforward. I'm not going to go into the reasons why this works. But remember, the given a first stage decision X, this is what we have to solve. We have to solve QY subject to, now the right-hand side is fixed, WY equals H minus TX. And if we take the pi being the duals, then we simply write E sub L equals pi transpose T, and small e sub L be pi, let that be pi transpose H, and then we're done with our cut. So moving on to the algorithm, what it does is it solves the master problem in step one, it checks for feasibility in step two, it checks for optimality in step three, and I'm not going to go through the details here, but hopefully it's straightforward in the slides. And if it can't cut off the current solution with an optimality cut, you're done. Otherwise, if you add a cut either in step two or in step three, you go back to step one. Okay, moving forward. This is just I have a quick cartoon of what this looks like. What these cuts will look like come up in red. And you see we might generate that one. I'm just clicking it a few times. My first red line, second red line, and a third red line, and so on. And you can see, because it's piecewise linear, if we added a finite set of cuts, we would actually get the entire function from below. But often we don't have to do that. We can simply add the cuts in the area that we're interested in. Okay, so briefly, I just want to, moving forward, the multi-cut version, instead of having a single variable theta, we might have a bunch, one for each scenario, and people have looked at kind of hybrid versions of this, but multi-cut can work well if there aren't too many scenarios. What people have found is that if you have integer first stage, multi-cut's pretty much a terrible idea because you have to solve every time at every iteration, at least in the general form, you have to resolve a mixed integer master problem, and you really don't want to add, the adding a bunch of constraints, one for each scenario, that makes each LP in the branch and bound process much more difficult to solve. So this is this can be orders of magnitude worse in the case where you have integer first stage. Okay, moving forward, I want to talk again briefly about stochastic integer programs. The recourse function Q becomes non-convex and discontinuous. It has very few properties, unless we put very strong conditions on them. And the absence of general effective, I wouldn't say efficient, effective, generally effective methods reflects this. People have been focusing on very special structure. And I would say that no industrial-sized problems with integer recourse have been solved thus far. But yet, of course, from a modeling perspective, it would be really nice to have this. This is something that is occurring all the time, at least without a fair amount of special structure. But certainly I believe, and I think other people do as well, that this is something that's going to be, people are going to be looking at in the future. Okay, moving on. How do I solve stochastic IPs? I might skip this. I'm going to go over this very briefly. We don't really know a lot is the takeaway on this. And there's a general method called the integer L-shape method, but it's something that I don't think... I think it's almost too general to work well, at least on these types of things. I mean, the cuts that they generate are very weak, typically. Okay, moving forward, I want to talk also about multi-stage stochastic programs. So there's no reason we need to limit ourselves to two stages. And so I've written out here, on whatever slide this is, the formulation for a n-stage stochastic program. And so instead of AX equals B, we have W1 X1 equals H1. But then what you can see here is that you can have a whole set of constraints, not just for every scenario, but for every stage. And one thing I want to point out here is that we have the constraints here that we only have T and W interacting for two consecutive stages. So we don't necessarily... So people try to maintain This, so to some extent, we might view this as a Markovian property of some kind, though that omega is allowed to maintain to contain a whole lot of information from the whole history. So, again, this is very daunting. When I mentioned that just a two-stage problem is very hard to just throw into a computer, this is hopeless. I mean, even if you just had a toy problem that we teach the first week of undergrads, to our undergrads in our first week, if you set that out to, you know, eight stages or something, it can become very big very quickly. So going forward, the one property that we want to talk about is non-anticipativity. So, let me go through with a little bit of slides. Here we have a very simple three-stage model, and at every stage, you imagine that, let's say, demand could either be high or low. So starting out at the decision we need to make now, the decisions next month, the demand could either be high or low, and then in stage three, they could also be high or low. So scenario one would correspond to two consecutive high demand periods. Scenario three would be first low demand, then high demand, that type of thing. So, again, this is one where I'm going to need a little help with the animation. Hitting the mouse again, we would describe the decision we need to make in scenario one as X3 of omega 1. So X3, remember, means that's the third state decision under scenario one. Similarly, for the last four, I've hit the mouse or the spacebar four times now. And then what happens is that we have the principle that scenarios 1 and 2 must be indistinguishable in stage 2. We cannot allow the model to make different decisions in at time period 2 for scenario 1 and scenario 2. Okay? We're not going to allow the model to have a crystal ball. And mathematically, what we mean is that two terminal scenarios are indistinguishable if the unique path from the root node to both scenarios is identical up to that point. And so we must have that scenario that the decisions are the same up to those points. Now, this isn't such a big deal for two-stage programs. We can easily separate Y's and X's in this case, but we have to be very careful for at what point do we allow scenarios to, or the vectors for scenarios to be different. So hitting the slide again, we're going to enforce, actually, that X2 of omega 1 has to be equal to X2 of omega 2. So in other words, the decision we made, if we knew that scenario 1 were going to be the case, we're going to occur, the variable. So in other words, the decision we make at time period 2 for both scenario 1 and scenario 2 has to be the same, because at this point we don't know the difference between them. In stage 2, we're allowed to make different decisions for scenario 2 and scenario 3, because the unique path from the root node to scenario 2 and the unique path from the root node to scenario 3 do not go through the same node at stage 2. Okay. Pretty simple to do. This causes a lot of complications, though, with multi-stage programs. So you can also see that we're going to require that the decision X2 of omega 3 be equal to X2 of omega 4. Okay, and then everything has to be the same at stage 1. Okay, so for this problem, these would be the non-anticipativity constraints. If we just wrote down this set of constraints, we could actually solve them independently. And so what people will do is consider those linking constraints non-anticipativity constraints, rather, to be linking constraints. And people will use Lagrangian relaxation for this, but as you can imagine, the number of non-anticipativity constraints that are required grows very, very, very quickly, not only with the number of stages, but the number of branches that are permitted at each stage. Okay. So moving forward, as I just mentioned, you can decompose the model by scenario, but then you have to have non-anticipativity constraints as linking constraints. What people have tried to do is Lagrangian relaxation, but again, as I stated, the number of possible non-anticipativity constraints is enormous. So I'm moving on to nested Bender's decomposition. This is something that's been proposed. I don't know of any modern implementations of this algorithm. It generalizes the L-shaped method. Candidate solutions are passed from stage T to T plus 1, and then you have optimality cuts or feasibility cuts move backwards from T plus 1 to T. I do not have a figure for that, but you can imagine what happens as we're moving these decisions. And, of course, There are a lot of, if this is ever going to be an effective method, and no one really knows that for sure, you're going to have to, there are a lot of issues that are going to have to be worked out in terms of these things, what kind of computational strategies will work. One thing I should mention is that one advantage to the Lagrangian method with the non-anticipativity constraints is that if you're willing to put up with the duality gap, you can use you can actually apply that to integer decisions. You know, it may not work well. You're going to have a gap at the end, but something like nested Bender's decomposition has no hope with integer solutions, except possibly in the first stage. Okay. Moving forward to continuous distributions. This is how I'm going to spend the rest of the time, and I'm actually going pretty quickly, so feel free to stop if there are any questions. But it's hard, since I can't see most of you, it's hard to for me to get a sense as to, you know, whether or not this is just old hat or not. So, can stochastic programming models handle continuous distribution? And the answer is probably. Under many circumstances, and certainly, you know, another answer might be yes in the limit, but, you know, in terms of practical issues, there are a lot of things that come up. So, with a continuous distribution, obviously there are many scenarios, and the relationship for the expectation of the expected value function, instead of having a sum sigma, we have an integral. And when you're integrating over LP value functions, that becomes very much more difficult to handle. The extensive form formulation is infinitely large, but there are ways to overcome these difficulties. And also, in essence, I would say most of these are ways to kind of try to pull this back into the finite scenario world, keeping in mind that there are statistical issues with doing that. So, I'm going to talk to you about three or four ways that people have proposed to handle these problems. So, next slide. The sample average approximation. This is a method that has received a lot of interest, I'd say, in the last 10 years. And so what this does is we are going to sample from the continuous distribution. And there are a lot of ways to sample. I mean, anytime you use even something like ARENA, they are sampling from distributions, discrete or continuous. And there are standard ways you can do this in a computer. It typically involves generating pseudo-random 0-1 numbers and putting that into the inverse cumulative probability distribution in order to find out, to get samples. We're going to give, then, each scenario probability the probability 1 over n. So this looks like a straightforward Monte Carlo simulation approach, but there's more to it here. So one question is, in practice, is how big should n be? And there are some suggestions in the literature on how big, n should be. And so going forward a slide is that two of the big problems we have is the exact evaluation of the expected recourse function. That's actually very difficult, even for a fixed x. You can imagine that. I mean, it requires the numerical solution of an infinite dimensional of an integral. And the integral isn't something nice like, you know, f of x equals x squared minus 6x or something. It's the optimal value function given a particular right-hand side of a linear program. And so, you know, that's we can come up with closed-form solutions for that. You know, it could be the maximum over a certain set of dual extreme points of the dual polyhedron, but there are enormous numbers of that. And so, you know, actually keep in mind here that we are integrating the optimal solution of a set of LPs. And so this is very hard. This is much more difficult than, you know, something MATLAB can do, integrating, you know, f of x equals something really nasty, but still a closed-form solution. And then not only do we have to do that, it's even difficult to evaluate it for a particular value x, but then we have to optimize this whole thing over a function that we really can't properly evaluate. We can do it in a numerical sense, but in a mathematical sense, it's very difficult to do in a certain sense. Okay, so the SAA attempts to address the both difficulties. One thing I'm going to say, and I've not been too active in this area, but this is an area that requires, it almost invokes religious fervor almost among stochastic programming people. This is, you know, the analogy I'd make is economics. Most economists will agree on microeconomics, but macroeconomics, you know, there's just some fundamental disagreement often that people will have. And I would say that you know, the number of times I've seen people upset in these types of talks, typically ways you evaluate continuous distributions is one of the areas. And so I want to give you a sense of the four kind of active areas, but I will say that often proponents of one of these methods are, you know, disdainful of another. So this is something that, you know, we don't often see, I think, in optimization, but this is something that may be an exception. Okay, so moving forward, the main idea of SAA is that, again, we're going to generate a random sample of n realizations of the particular random vector. Now, remember, this random vector psi of omega could contain information such as the second stage right-hand side, the second stage objective function, both the T and the W matrices. And so this could be an enormously large vector, depending on the size of the problems you're trying to look at. And so remember, if you have continuous distributions here, this is a very difficult thing to try to handle. And so keep in mind that this is a random vector, and it's really a random vector that describes for you everything you need to know about the recourse problem. And so then we're going to approximate this Q of X by simply 1 divided by n. We're going to give everything the equal probability, and then we're going to sum up the expected value of X given this scenario. Now, this is something I know how to do. This X problem there, that's just a simple LP. Okay? So we're simply going to take N, and again, there's some art to selecting N properly, but this seems like a very straightforward thing to do. This is something that I think our seniors who, having taken simulation, would suggest as a reasonable thing to do. So, again, so this is just, we would simply take a bunch of LPs, and we will average the optimal objective function value. Well, there's got to be more to it than that, and there is. So let's go forward. So this is, again, the minimization problem that we're going to look at, the first line there on the SAA main idea. We solved that using a deterministic optimization algorithm. You can use the L-shaped method, Benders, Flavors, whatever you'd like to do. And then we're going to let's see, what Greek letter is that? That's a psi or a what? Oh, yeah, see, okay, fair enough. So it's a different C from what we've been using either earlier. But anyway, CNXN be the optimal value of this SAA problem. And then we'll let C star and X star denote the optimal value. Now, there's no reason to believe that these are going to be anywhere near each other, particularly for small values of N. So this is where the statistics comes in. And we need to try to figure out just how close, how good an estimate these are, and whether or not we need to repeat this procedure, and in fact, we do. So I'm going to go forward. So the addresses that we need to look at is, do CN and XN converge to their true counterparts? Clearly, if you were to sample infinitely often for the rest of time, that would in fact be the case. Can we analyze the rate of convergence? It's and how big does N have to be in order we can get a confidence interval around? So, can I say within with a certain level of confidence, I know I'm within a certain range of the optimal answer. Again, statistics is a natural, we're not going to be able to get away from statistical issues with these types of things. And then can we look at optimization approaches for solving these problems? And then another issue we're going to look at down the road, and in fact this is a whole other topic that I'll discuss, is variance reduction techniques. And why would we want variance reduction techniques? Well, if we can reduce the variance of our estimates, we can come up with tighter bounds around them. Okay. So, next slide. It turns out that it's been shown, and the reference I have is Rüdiger Schultz from 1996, but he was not the first to consider this. It goes back earlier. A solution to the SAA problem is going to converge to the solution of the true problem as n goes to infinity. But as John Maynard Keynes said, in the long run, we are all dead. So this doesn't necessarily help us from an algorithmic point of view. So when we have discrete distributions, but perhaps with a countable but enormous number of scenarios, then we can it turns out that we can get an exact optimal solution with the probability approaching 1 exponentially fast as n increases. This was done by Alex Shapiro and Tito Holman and DeMello as part of Tito's dissertation back in 1998. The next slide. This has been extended really by a Georgia Tech. Really, it's Alex Shapiro, I think, who's been doing a lot of the work here at Georgia Tech. So this Klevecht et al. That was another paper with Alex Shapiro, and they've been extending the convergence of this method to the situation where the set of first stage decisions is finite. So in other words, not a stochastic LP, but perhaps a stochastic IP in the first stage and LP in the second stage, where there's an infinitely large number of, you know, where we have a continuous distribution in the second stage. Shabir Ahmed, who's one of Nick Sahanidi's students from about 8-10 years ago, and Alex Shapiro, they're both at Georgia Tech, extended these results to two-stage stochastic programs with integer recourse, where the space of feasible first-stage decisions is, in fact, infinite. So this is quite a step from Clavecht et al. But really, I'd say a lot, at least in terms of trying to extend, get fundamental understandings of SAA. Alex Shapiro, this has really been one of his major focuses over the last 10, perhaps 20 years, is looking at these types of problems. Okay, next the next slide is a couple things. We can't come up with theoretical bounds to give epsilon optimal solutions on N. They're typically far too conservative to obtain. The idea, you know, what people have done in practice is to adjust N dynamically depending on what your observed variance was and that type of thing, and what the confidence interval actually was. And like a lot of things in large-scale optimization, there are trade-offs, and it's to some extent an art form. You know, do you want to spend more time on larger Ns? Do you want to resolve several times to try to get a range of you know, sample more times, or do you want to have fewer samples with larger Ns and that type of thing? So this is something, again, that unfortunately there's no single bullet. People are still trying to explain, and I suspect it's going to be problem-dependent, what the best set of N, and to some extent distribution-dependent, too. You know, for a nice structured distribution, you may get different answers than if you're using empirical sampling from empirical distributions. Okay, next slide. I just have a little figure on how what one version of SAA might be. And so we start out initializing. We have an initial sample size N, and then we want to set a decision rule for determining the number M of iterations, set T equals 0. We're going to create a sample size N and solve the SAE problem. We're going to come up with the optimality gap, and we're going to estimate the variance of the gap estimator. If they're small enough, if the variance gap and the optimality gap and the variance of the gap estimator are sufficiently small, I have these flipped. If the answer is yes, then obviously we terminate, unfortunately. If the answer is no, so the two arrows emanating from 2.3 should be flipped. I'm sorry I missed that. If it turns out that they're not sufficiently small, then either if T is less than M, then we're going to increment T. Oh, I'm sorry, then we're going to increase the sample size, N, and actually reset the counter, and then we're going to repeat it, basically. So this is, you know, kind of a brute force method of trying to come up with good estimates of this problem. Okay, moving forward. People have used sampling actually in the L-shaped method. So remember, you might view SAE as kind of external sampling. The sampling is external to the algorithm. I'm going to come up with a representation of the distribution, and then I will solve that as though it's a deterministic problem. At the end, I will keep in mind that, in fact, it is not a deterministic or a finite scenario problem, rather. And I will use my knowledge of statistics to see whether or not I'm done. Another way of doing this is actually, I'm going to just start out with the L-shaped method, and I'm going to sample within this. And so a couple ways that we're going to do that, I'll talk about briefly about importance sampling, which was, you know, when I first started reading about stochastic programming in the mid-90s or so, this was something that, you know, there were only four books on it, and one of them was written by someone who'd applied importance sampling. But since then, I wouldn't say that there's been a large amount of activity. I'd say that SAA and this second topic on this slide have been more active research areas. And I wouldn't feel confident saying that that's been a scientifically justified reason for that. It just could be that this is such a small field, and turns out that, you know, no one's, there's just been, no, it hasn't had a champion. So we'd like to reduce the variance. This is really coming out of a statistic or simulation, but this was one of the last things Danzig worked on in stochastic programming with one of his colleagues, Infinger. And so we'd like to reduce the variance somehow using important sampling, which is a well-known technique in simulation, to try to reduce the variance from the sample. But then also Heigl and Sen, who when they developed this were at Arizona and they're now at Ohio State, have used stochastic decomposition. They've developed a technique that they call stochastic decomposition that tries to sample, use a single sample stream to drive cuts that are eventually going to become, to essentially fade out, phase out, and I'll show you what that means. Okay, so important sampling. Again, this is a standard technique. It probably goes back to the 50s or something in terms of people using this in just in general simulation. Danzig and Glynn did this, again, around 20 years ago. Danzig, obviously, had quite an interest in stochastic linear programs, and Glynn what is one of the biggest names, I'd say, in simulation. He's also at Stanford, and stochastics in general, but certainly simulation. And, you know, he's certainly one of the luminaries in the field. And Infinger was also there and worked to some extent with Danzig, but he also wrote this book. And so the idea is to sample Q in the L-shaped method instead of actually computing it, and then we can get some convergence results. So moving forward, there's a little bit of math. What we do is we have this Q, and that's unfortunate that I have Q of Xi there, because that's also the second stage objective function, unfortunately. It's actually quite a challenge to get consistent notation across, as I think those of you who are writing dissertations know. So, again, we've given a probability mass function. You see the last thing I've written on that slide is induced to reduce the variance. And there are various ways that one can do that. But this is the general idea, that instead of crude Monte Carlo sampling, which you can see there, important sampling, if you choose the cues cleverly, you can have dramatic reductions in the variance. Okay, so going forward, there's a formula that I'm not going to go through for what the variance is, and if you can get the Q done properly, you can reduce this amount. Minimizing that is a difficult problem, but it turns out by using important samplings within the L-shaped method, they get actually estimates on all the coefficients on the cuts. So we get, it's kind of interesting, we get confidence intervals on what each of the cuts are. And when we optimize that, we take those confidence intervals into account. So rather than knowing that we have a supporting hyperplane, we have something, and we might actually be cutting something off. So it's an interesting world that I think many of us aren't used to thinking about things in that way. Okay, going forward, the last thing I'm going to talk about is stochastic decomposition, and so this has been developed for, again, the classical two-stage LPs with complete recourse. The idea is that we're going to sample to create cuts on each iteration of the L-shaped algorithm, but what's interesting here and what they needed to do in order to prove convergence is that the cuts are given less weight as the algorithm progresses. So the first sample I'm going to come up with is very important on iteration 1, becomes less important on iteration 2, and then on iteration 400, it actually almost carries no weight at all. Okay, and so there were mathematical reasons that they needed to do it this way in order to prove convergence, and they can, as I recall, the convergence only shows on a subsequence or something. I mean, you know, from like a, if you remember from Weierstrass's theorem. But in practice, they claim that this works well. Okay, so going forward, and I will say that I think that Heigl and Sen's interests have now moved to extending this to stochastic integer programs rather than pushing this method to solve stochastic linear programs. So they've established that it works that it converges well, and that, you know, the basic method will work. But to my knowledge, there's not a wide, not a group of people who are seeing how do we really take this and apply it to large scale problems. Okay, The next one, a little bit of mathematical description. This should look familiar. Don't let the notation, this is exactly what we've solved. We're going to come up with an initial sample and simply solve a finite scenario stochastic program in step one. And then in step two, we're going to increment V, and then we're going to come up with an independent sample. Now, here's the thing. We're going to give each scenario equal weight, so 1 over V there, and then create the cuts the normal way. But in step 3, what you will see is, in fact, all the previous cuts are given a slightly smaller weight. Okay, so for everyone, S equals 1 through V minus 1, the weight of this cut to some extent. We're gonna change we don't change the x, but these are still valid inequalities, but we are changing reducing the magnitude of these coefficients. And as time goes on, these are gonna be, now those of you who have implemented algorithms are gonna wonder about numerical stability of these types of things. I mean, as we're going on and V equals, 100,000, you come up with very nasty things in terms of machine precision. And so that's why certainly their early work was more focused on the convergence properties of these algorithms. I think and in terms of actual implementation, when you do something like this, I think your first concern would be the finite precision of your machine. And so in practice, you may come up with something that comes up with answers that may be more accurate, but it's not at all clear that if you change this procedure that you'll come up with convergence methods, that the method will converge. The convergence, as I recall, was not a robust convergence. It was fairly fragile. And then there are updating phases. So that's what they do. And again, I think that I view myself to some extent as very much an outsider. In terms of, I don't have a horse in this race, but I will say I had a student who finished his dissertation. We're working on the paper, and the method I chose to use for a large scale healthcare problem was the SAA method, the first one I used. I just feel that it's a little bit, it's a little bit more of a robust technique, and I feel like there's been, it has more grounding in terms of extensions to integer recourse and that type of thing. Okay, so convergence again. They've shown that it can converge under certain conditions. The convergence, as I would say, my view on that is it's not necessarily that the certain conditions is actually somewhat restrictive, and it's more from a mathematical understanding point of view than from a practical convergence kind of thing. And in the last 10 years, since these works have come out, maybe 15 years, Heigl has really become more of an administrator. I think she's still active on some of these things, but Sen has really taken this into a different direction. But he's been really interested in working on general methods for stochastic integer programs. But I believe he's now looking at extending these techniques to stochastic IPs. Okay, so a couple other things. One last thing I want to mention is scenario reduction. So it would be great if we could, and this idea goes way back. People have looked at this in other contexts, stochastic dynamic programming, that type of thing. If we could come up with fewer scenarios that essentially give us the same amount of information, that would be a great thing computationally. Can we come up with a small number of scenarios that are good approximations? Well, the answer is perhaps, and there are people who've looked at these types of problems. This is actually an active area with a number of people in Europe right now, and the idea to come up with an optimal scenario reduction problem, it's not at all clear to me from a practical point of view that this is any easier than solving the whole stochastic program, but this is an area that right now is attracting some theoretical interest. Moving forward, of course, it naturally turns out to be an NP-hard problem. But Heitz and Romisch has been very active in stochastic programming, and he's in East Berlin, and I'm going to butcher this name, Dupakova in the Czech Republic. has been working on various ways of trying to come up with scenario reduction techniques. Okay, so in conclusion, this is something that I think it's really, certainly for stochastic LPs, we're at the point where, and stochastic programs where with continuous recourse, or continuous decision variables, this is something where practical problems are being solved, and so that's an exciting change, I'd say, over 15 years ago. I'd say that there are significant potential in enterprise-wide optimization, but these problems are hard to solve, and moreover, I think that more than in deterministic problems, the harder the problems get, the more important the initial model becomes, and this is no different at all. And I believe that industrial-sized stochastic programs can now be solved. Not only do I believe it, you can see it for yourself at the conferences these days. And so I think that the future is bright. I think that for continuous distributions, which is, again, is the focus of the second half of our talk, I'd say that it really depends on how important being certain that you have the mathematical understanding and proofs of guarantees of convergence are out there, but again, they may require an infinitely large number of iterations, that type of thing. In terms of practical problems, again, it's probably instance dependent, and it really depends on what's important to you. Is it important to is the understanding the uncertainty the critical aspect, or is it really important that we get a lot of fidelity in terms of the decision variables? It really comes down to how do you want to spend your modeling time and your computational time. But certainly, there are ways that we can come up with mathematically satisfying ways that also will give provably that can be implemented in practice. And my opinion is that the sample average approximation method is currently the way that is best balancing those two concerns. And I believe that is the last slide.
Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you.
Are there any questions out there? Anybody's out there?
Yeah.
Let me ask one question.
Yeah.
Andrew, one of the things that you mentioned is, problems where you have a huge number of scenarios, and
yes,
that happens, of course, very often because you have discrete distribution functions,
right,
and many parameters.
Right.
Now, the question is, how can you exactly apply or extend the sampled average approximation to those problems? Because the way you presented it was in the context of continuous distributions. I would imagine that
it's the same way.
It's the same.
Yeah, yeah. It's pretty easier.
Same.
Yeah,
yeah,
yeah. But you have to be careful about, do you believe that the parameters are independent or not? If they're not, that becomes more difficult, obviously, to sample. But that's simply, the SAA method simply will require, I don't know if I go back quite a ways, it simply assumes you have a black box that will give you reasonable samples. And so certainly continuous distributions, we know how to do that, but also discrete distributions, it's in some respects even easier.
Yeah.
And so independence is a major issue. Do you believe that the objective function is independent? And moreover, is it time dependent? Can I truly sample the objective function from 2001 and the constraints from 2004? I mean, most problems you'd probably say no, but for a continuous distribution, we're assuming some kind of underlying functional form typically, or something built from a statistical estimate. And certainly, if you have an enormous number, a practically infinite number of discrete distributions, all these techniques will also apply. They leave all they require is that you can generate an independent sample of an arbitrary size.
Good, thank you. So, yes,
Larry. Ignacio, I have a question.
Yeah.
This is José from Praxair. Andrew, is it possible to, when you apply those sampling methods, If you build a solution from a small size n,
yeah,
and you increase the size and keep the, can you take advantage? Supposedly, if you keep the same sample and just add new points to your sample, can you still take advantage of the previous solution in building that?
I want to be a little careful here. I understand exactly what you're saying. So just to repeat the question, it's that if I tried to build the answer with a sample size of 500, and for some reason I didn't like that, and then tried it with 5,000, can I use the information for 500? And I want to give you a cautious answer on that, which is the answer is I'm not 100% sure that, but my belief is that there are ways to do that. But okay. you never know, because unlike other samples, obviously if I were simply sampling from any distribution, that would work. But the fact that I've now optimized over it from a from a mathematical cleanly convergence perspective, it could be possible that old information will not help you. But certainly, I think from a practical point of view, if you were trying to solve one of these problems in practice, my advice would be, that you should not throw that information away, even if you can't use it, put it into a formula that will provide a certain estimate on some of these, on how good your estimate is.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, Larry?
I was going to ask two things. One, nice talk, by the way. Are you going to have a slide on references?
No, that's a. I will, depending on how soon I can find a grad student, I can do that.
Right. Absolutely, that would be great.
Yes.
The second thing I was going to say is it looks like, given the structure of the problem and the inequality constraints, it sounds like a natural way to apply some kind of interior point method for these kinds of decompositions.
That's right. That's right.
You want to say something about that?
Yeah, it's something that I've been a little bit surprised that hasn't been of more interest in, and I think part of it is that the stochastic integer programming has been such an active area relative to this. But one thing I will say, and this I think is that a very nice treatment of this is, it's now a 12-year-old book or something, but Burge and Louveau is the book I still teach out of when I teach stochastic programming. And one thing I think that's very impressive is that Burge, with one of his students, looked at this in 1989 or something like that, 1980, right after interior points came out,
really?
so that was, for interior points, that was, almost the dawn of time kind of thing. And so, but he had ideas, and Nick may have an opinion on this too. Impressed me, he had a lot of thoughts on how you should do this in interior point methods. And then they sat on someone's shelf for 10 years. I forget who it was, but someone investigated these old ideas of Burge and his students, and they were dead on. I mean, they were exactly, his intuition was exactly right, those two. And so there's a sequence of papers there, but it does, you have to be very careful with certain issues, obviously, numerical linear algebra issues when you implement one of these things carefully, as of course you know. But that what Burge and his student recommended turned out to be, very close to what the best things were. But they didn't have the benefit of being able to solve these, these large-scale problems. It was just their intuition was dead on. But I think there's some things going on, but I would argue, if I had to look at this, why is it that interior point methods haven't been more important here? I would say that for many practical problems, we struggle with the whole idea of having a first stage continuous problem. An LP in the first stage is just not as natural, in my experience, as having an IP in the first stage. With decisions on where should I place things, what should I buy, those types of things typically, I think, are capital decisions or structural decisions of those kinds. And honestly, for a pure stochastic LP, where LP genuinely makes sense in the first stage, financial issues are ones where people have looked at it. But I think in terms of like enterprise-wide optimization issues, my intuition is that integer first stage is so important that people have just been throwing this thing into CPLEX. And CPLEX would probably be the right way. Can you use those cleverly within MIP? And the answer is often we're still struggling to do that, as opposed to dual simplex with resolves. So, I think that, the answer is people have looked at it, but I believe there's certain other, that applications are driving us away from really understanding large-scale two-stage LPs.
Okay, Nick, the last question.
Yes.
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 came to distributions, probability distributions, he said, in practice, those things don't exist, but right? They do, they exist in our imagination.
Right. To comment on that,
yeah.
I think.
Can you repeat the question?
Yeah. Okay. So next question was, you know, he saw a talk by Dmitry Bertsimas at MIT, who's you know, of course, been very active in virtually everything, but is certainly been taking a lot of interest in robust optimization and as opposed to stochastic programming. And actually, his student, I don't know if he's on this, but you know, Melvin Sim, one of his students at Singapore, has started trying to look at deep ties between stochastic programming and robust optimization, and that's you know, again, another very active area. But I think that there's definitely, I would agree in some respects that a robust approach, you know, in practice may make sense. So robust would be, you know, the classical definition of robust is I want to do well over all scenarios, but I'm really worried about the worst scenario in some respects, or some subset of bad scenarios in some areas. So, you know, it is a little less risk neutral than stochastic programming. Now, you know, there are more generalized versions of that, but I think that there's definitely, and they've been able to establish that robust problems for most, perhaps most instances, many instances, are not that much harder to solve than their non-robust counterparts. And so I think that that's another thing that I think that he's making a good point, that robust optimization is certainly another thing that should be used. I don't want to say too much more without being asked to give a talk on robust optimization in a year, but...
okay. Well, I think on that note, let me again thanks.
All right,
Andrew,
thank you all very much.
For very, very nice, outstanding talk. So
thank you.
And just so everybody knows, our next talk will be by Larry Snyder in November out of Lehigh on multi-echelon inventory. If I remember correctly, I think it's November 13, but I'll send you an email to confirm the date. Okay? Thank you, everybody. Bye-bye.
All right.